You're not tapping. Well, it has to do with the diaphragmatic and the Excelsior button here. And
that's all very technical.
Framasam,
little thingy over there.
It's the Framasam that goes into the discombobulator.
Okay. Here we go.
Anyway. Hi, I'm Dave Dufour.
I'm John Schaup.
And I'm Marcia Fulmer. And we are Theater Geeks.
Hi there, welcome to Theater Geeks, the podcast about community theater and the performing arts. We have a special guest here with us today, Ron Ziegler from the American Association of Community Theaters. And it is November, but it's not too early to be thinking about festival. And one of the issues that we thought we'd talk to Ron today about, first of all, welcome, Ron.
My pleasure to be here.
And what we wanted to talk about today was a little bit about what it takes to have a good festival versus maybe a not so great festival. I mean, what are some do's and don'ts basically is kind of what we're kind of thinking that we'd like to talk about. What is your function position with AACT, by the way, Ron? Let's start
I am on staff of the AACT, and my title is Field Services Director. Okay. What that means exactly, I actually work very heavily with the festivals during festival cycle as a consultant to the various state festivals if they need help. And I'm also involved in writing the festival handbook, and I go to probably maybe 25 to 30 festivals during the course of a cycle too. I always tell people I have the best job in the world because my job is to travel around to festivals.
There's two sides to that. Festivals can be pretty grueling, especially if you've got to do a whole lot of them in a row, right?
That's exactly it. And I do spend a lot of time in the air, which is interesting. But besides that, I do a variety of other functions for ACT with membership and recruitment and retention. But for now, let's just talk about festivals because that's really what I'm most heavily involved in at this point.
Right, right.
You said the festival season. What does that run from what to what?
Well, festival cycle, it runs it's every 2 years. And actually, we're well into the 2015 cycle already. We've had eight festivals so far during the course of the fall, beginning back in last April with the first one in Maine.
That would be the state festivals, right?
Those are the state festivals, right? And there actually has been one regional festival, and that's Region 10, and that's in the American military theaters overseas.
Okay, I have to ask you this though. Isn't it really difficult for most community theaters to do to actually do a festival, say, in the fall of a show that they probably did maybe on their own stages several months earlier, and then have to wait another several months to go to a regional or potentially a national festival? Do you think that's too big a space of time? It's hard to keep casts together sometimes for that.
That's actually the biggest problem is keeping cast together. We've had multiple occasions of cast members having to drop away. And then it's okay for theaters to replace cast members. They just have to petition to do it. And it's almost pro forma at this stage. But
yeah,
there is some difficulty to it. I think it's a matter of what mindset a theater takes. If they planned well in advance, I mean, usually theaters know when their festival's coming around, and they actually know at what point in the cycle they are. So it's a matter of planning well in advance, and do a couple pickup rehearsals along the way, and try to keep it fresh. But boy, there's a lot of theaters that do it. Like for example, the Colorado Festival was in August, and you know their regional won't even be till the spring, let alone the national. So it's a long time to keep something alive. That's true.
Right.
But as a matter of mindset, I think more than anything.
Right. Okay. So if you're starting from scratch, is the first thing scheduling and making sure that it doesn't conflict with other things, or is there something else you ought to be thinking about before you even start doing that? I mean, assuming that you're a state, and we do have one state right now that is doing a state festival for the first time in a number of years. So what are they looking at, or what should they be looking at?
Well, I think the real key is to start early, certainly there are a lot of festivals. The one I'm working with on the West Coast, they haven't done a festival for a long time, but they've got some experienced people that are guiding them. So it helps a little bit, and they really didn't have the time to do a lot of planning because that's been one that we've been working on putting together for quite a while. But starting well in advance makes it easier. Let me just put it that way.
Yeah.
And making sure you have the personnel to execute it. And by personnel, I don't necessarily mean paid staff, but enthusiastic volunteers pull up a lot of the slack in a festival. And boy, one good festival chair drawn from the volunteer ranks is worth their weight in double their weight in gold, because they'll keep things honest and keep on track all the way.
Right. What about dealing with, well, okay, so what's next? Venues are always kind of the issue, and yep. You try to, you know, planning around, and it isn't just the performance venue, but it's also in most cases, it's having hotels and proper lodging nearby that people are going to want to go to, for starters. Absolutely. And so that's kind of an issue too, isn't it?
It is. And the proximity of hotels is important, but affordability is also important. So I think it's a good idea to provide certainly a host hotel, but an alternative hotel that has that's a little more budget conscious than perhaps the host hotel is.
Right.
Because people don't necessarily have to stay in the host hotel to participate in activities within that space. But a hotel that's got some party space is a good idea too. So you can have your afterglows and preliminary events, and because theater people, you probably don't know this, but theater people like to party.
No, really?
Okay.
I'll have to
check into that.
Ron, how important is the handbook in the whole process then?
It's really critical, and the handbook, there's revisions to the handbook every 2 years for every cycle, every 2 years. So every now and then we'll run into a festival that accidentally glommed onto a handbook from cycles old. And then they're not operating under the same set of rules that everyone else is.
So what changes?
Yes, it does. It changes. Certain things will change every cycle because we want to make the handbook a living document. We learn things continuously from the festivals that would make them go more smoothly. We've had a real effort over the last couple of cycles to make the rules, what's the best way to put this, less punitive and more instructive.
I see.
You know what I'm
saying? Because what we discovered is a lot of the rules arose because of, say, a certain circumstance at a festival somewhere years ago.
Yeah.
For some reason got codified and nobody knows why. So we discover stuff like that all the time. Here's a for example of one of the rules that changed this year. We've said in the past that people prohibited from participating in festival would be people who make their living as actors. Equity members. But we also had a rule that said, well, if you make up to half your salary as an actor, you're also exempt from that. Well, here's the thing. People who make their salaries as actors are also members of the community. And if they're and usually if they're not an equity member and are willing to give up a salary for the course of the rehearsal and performance period of that show, well, who are we to say they can't participate? Now, we do still exempt equity and SAG-AFTRA members, but that's because they've made a dedicated commitment to be professional actors, and their unions really won't let them do it without pay, without some kind of compensation, whether it even be a contribution to the insurance fund.
I see.
That alone makes it so they're being paid for the festivals. So they're the ones that are exempt. But somebody who makes a living as a mostly an amateur actor and picks up a lot of money, any amount of money doing commercials or doing little professional productions here and there, we thought we're just punishing people for making a living in the theater when what we're promoting is live theater.
Right.
So why exempt them? So that's one of the rules that changed, that we decided to make it less punitive for those who are still dedicated community theater people.
And that's just been within within the last 2 years. So that's new for this cycle.
That's correct. That's within this very cycle.
Okay.
Hey, well, like, here's a change I'd like. Can you make the box bigger?
Oh, God. Yeah. It's like, suck it in, fellas. Yeah.
Yeah, well, the box, the dreaded box, that's kind of the, that's the,
people don't know if they've ever been to a festival.
You have to put your whole set within a lined out box, usually 10 by 10, and your actors have to start there and end there. And there's a whole lot of rules for how that all works. And it's, well,
There's another change. The actors no longer have to start and end in the box.
Right.
Oh, really? Oh, okay. Well, that's helpful.
Just, they just have to be adjacent. Is that right?
They have to be. No, they have to be anywhere the stage manager thinks they are. And if the person on stage that says that they are done should be connected with the company. And as long as they know where their actors are and want to stop, that's their priority.
Oh, I see.
So you don't have to come back to the box anymore?
You do not have to come back to the box.
What? What?
Having spent years in the box.
Holy crap. Now I'm change, thinking about this. You know, you go, in my day, we had to come back to the box.
Wasn't so easy then.
Yeah,
it wasn't so easy then,
but we liked it that way. We were disciplined.
We're going to keep doing it anyway.
We
just
were back
because.
In the box on time. But you still, now did you change, you didn't change the setup and takedown time. That's one thing that really, it's maybe can't change a whole lot because of you run into trouble with scheduling performances, you
know,
right?
As long as we schedule the way we are now, no, we really can't change that because it's just too it takes up too much time, even in rehearsal, let alone performance. But going back to the having to go back to the box rule, there are still a lot of companies who want to have their actors go back there anyway, just so they can keep track of them. But what we've done is made that the prerogative of the company instead of some rule, let me call it an arbitrary rule that people have to abide by. We just figured, well, you know, these are grown people, adults, and if they know how to keep track of their people, who are we to say how they have to do that? So that's right. An example of a rule that we got rid of that seemed to be more punitive than helpful.
Right. No. Well, it basically boils down to, if the stage manager says everybody's here, then everybody's here.
Exactly. It's a prerogative of the company, not of the rules of ACT.
Okay.
Now let me just talk for a second about the 10 by 10 box business. Now you understand the reason for that rule? I can tell you if you don't.
Well, then tell
no, we
us.
Don't know the reason for that
tell
rule.
Tell us.
Well, back in my day, you know, back at years and years ago when I started going to festivals, we'd have before there was that 10 by 10 rule, there some shows would bring in virtually a truckload of set.
And
number one, they'd take up half the wing space or half the shop to store their set in. And they'd bring, say, 30 people to set it up. Well, you know, you can put an awful lot of setup in that amount of time. And it made the set more the star of the show than acting and directing. Okay. So in order to keep the playing field level with theaters that can't possibly do that, afford to do it, or have the personnel to do it, that's where that 10 by 10 came from, limiting the size of the set and de-emphasizing the importance of the set in favor of acting and directing.
Well, except that, you know, I do have to say that very often watching the set go up and down and watching how well or not well that's going is sort of part of the entertainment for the audience, certainly.
It is interesting, but and part of the, you know, I don't know, I won't express a lot of opinions here. I'll just tell you why it's not necessarily my full opinion. There was a feeling that too much flamboyance in setting up the set was actually part of the production.
Right.
And where do you start the timing?
Oh, yeah. Right.
See? And there's also there was also a discussion, I remember, oh, God, this has been 15 years ago, about how setup and teardown, if it's done in theatrical fashion, would influence the adjudicators when what they should be looking at is acting and directing. So, you know, I don't know if I agree with all of that necessarily, but those are the reasons. And there may be some validity to it. In fact, I know there is some validity, at least.
Right.
Okay. You said the magic word for me, adjudicators. Okay. I think, how do you get them to be non-biased? And I mean, that when I hear grumbles about festivals, it's always that they were not given a fair shake from the adjudicators. I've seen adjudicators that think this is their time to take 5 minutes to do stand-up comedy at the expense of whatever show was just up. I mean, I know it's difficult. I critique shows myself, but I just wonder, what's your criteria for an adjudicator? Do they have to be totally out of the region or the state where these shows are being put on, so they have no connection with anybody in the production? Because that's happened several times.
Well, they shouldn't have any connection. If they have a connection with someone in the production, they're supposed to recuse themselves.
Oh, really? That's very interesting, and I hope it's in your rule book.
It is. It's in the instructions for the adjudicators.
Okay.
But ideally, people would be completely unconnected to the theaters and the festival, and would be from out of state. Of course, that's difficult, especially if you've got community theater people that are your adjudicators. And frankly, that, in my opinion, that works best because they understand what they're looking at. Now, the issue of standing up and doing a comedy routine for 5 minutes.
Just jokes at the expense of the production.
Well, I've seen it happen many times. What I suggest is that if people have that kind of an issue, that we find out about it, that I find out about it, because I'm the person that generally deals with adjudicator issues.
Right.
And my recommendation would be to not hire those people.
So how do you select if you're putting on a festival? How do you, and you're doing it, say, from scratch, what's your selection process usually? Does AACT have, I assume you have, I know you have a training program for adjudicators. Are they like certified then and kind of approved by AACT as being trained?
We don't certify adjudicators, but okay. We do keep records on evaluations of adjudicators we do evaluations at every festival, and we do keep those evaluations on file. In fact, I have them all. Mm-hmm. Now we're actually in a process of formalizing the adjudication records. Even now, I was in a meeting yesterday with a database developer that's setting up a new database for our adjudication process, our adjudication system. And in that database, we'll be able to keep everyone that's adjudicated for ACT, at least over the last, say 3 cycles.
Right.
That somebody who's chairing a festival who's looking for adjudicators will be able to access. And they'll be able to read the evaluations, and they'll be able to make a little bit more educated judgment along those lines. Now, unfortunately, sometimes there are other factors that enter into adjudicator selection. And one of the main ones is the expense of bringing in adjudicators. We do recommend that adjudicators receive a stipend. Not all do. But there's always going to be some expense involved in bringing an adjudicator. If they're from a long ways away, of course, you've got a larger travel expense, putting them up overnight, that sort of thing. And some smaller festivals have a real difficult time affording that. Now, I always advise them to build it into the registration fees.
Sure.
So that they have that available. Yeah. But it's always a consideration. So frequently you'll have a festival that'll grab, you know, whoever happens to be standing around that knows something about theater. I mean, I'm being a little facetious about that.
Right.
But that's where we've run into the most problem with quality of adjudication. If the adjudicator doesn't really understand the objectives of adjudication as ACT defines them, and B, if they really don't have the background with community theater to understand what it is they're looking at. Now, of course, I want to say that I think that percentage of people that adjudicate in the system is small. But I've seen a lot of adjudicators that, let's just say, wouldn't hold the standards that I would hope they would.
Right.
Well, you know, the groups that enter these festivals, all they get to take away from it is a win or a second place or whatever, or moving on. Right. And if they don't get the best and most objective criticism, what's the point? I mean, maybe you should put away more money to bring in outside adjudicators. I don't know, but it's not fair. And then I've seen some points where groups were so upset by the lack of unfair adjudicators that they just totally dropped out of coming back to festivals anymore because they weren't going to put themselves out for that.
Well, that's
it truly happens. And now the flip side of that is if an adjudicator is certainly honestly critical, but too critical, you lose people that way too.
Well, yeah, but I think they'd rather be too honestly critical than, you know, hear criticism from somebody that you know is already well in favor of another group.
I will tell you one thing that I always found kind of frustrating is that if you're one of the shows, and you know, and I've been you know involved in shows that have, you know, moved on to the next level and shows that haven't, but the only people that get any kind of really extensive critique and suggestions are the people that are moving on,
right.
And it's like, okay, yeah, we realize that we're not going on and we probably will pack this show away and that's we're not going to do it anymore, but it would really be great if a local festival allowed for the adjudicators to sit down even with the shows that didn't do as well and give them some honest critique. And I think that that's very helpful. And the 5 minutes that the adjudicators have is often kind of like, it's just a taste and you wish you could get more.
Yeah,
right, exactly. Well, I can give you an example of a festival that does that. And the Ohio Festival. Now they've got a real, I won't get into the details of what they do exactly, but they do have their adjudicators follow up with a written critique. Mm-hmm. Now that's it's asking a lot of an adjudicator, but I don't think it's too much. And they pay okay, so I mean, to me it's worth it.
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah.
As someone who adjudicates myself, I find that useful to hone adjudication skills because you really have to put things down in black and white instead of
right.
just thinking about it for the few minutes you're up there.
Yeah, well, it seems to me that would be good because then you have to back up whatever kind of criticism you make in 5 minutes. You really have to back that up with a solid reason for it, you know?
Exactly. Well, and some other festivals have a follow-up session with adjudicators. Indiana's one that has we used to, the first time I adjudicated the Indiana Festival, I said, "Oh, here's our grilling," but it's not really a grilling. It's really a useful conversation with the people that are there, and it makes adjudicators justify the way they approach adjudication. And I think that's right. I think that's good. I think it's all right to put the adjudicators on the hot seat.
Right. And I will tell
you, we'll remember that next time we see you.
Well, I will tell you that we're kind of maybe piling on a little bit here, but the my experience with mostly the adjudicators has been pretty positive. So they try to remain aloof so that they don't seem like they're playing favorites, you know, up until the point where, you know, the final judging is over. But, you know, you do learn a lot from them just in the socials being able to socialize.
Of course.
And I think that's wonderful.
Well, and I told you about the database that we're establishing for adjudicators, but beyond that, we're trying to make adjudication more accurate and more fair. And this is all part of this is a handbook change. The way it used to be with the way adjudicators tabulated the festival winners and whoever gets the subsidiary awards, the best actor, best actress, those sorts of things. You'd rank the shows first, and that's how the winning shows were chosen. And it was a majority rules situation. So there are three adjudicators. Two of them say one show is number one, and the third adjudicator has them ranked as number eight. It doesn't matter because two of them is number one.
Right.
Now that has changed. First of all, they don't tabulate up front. They do the secondary awards. What the advantage of that is that the adjudicators have a chance to really put a little more focus on what makes the productions good and what doesn't, what makes them less than the best by seeing where those caption awards are. And then when it gets time to choosing the winner. I kind of hate to use the word winner, except, you know, I'll use it that way for now. When it gets to that point, then they ballot like they always did before, but they have to be unanimous on every position.
Ah.
Oh, okay.
Well, that's good.
Well, when we talk about the caption awards, the people who are listening, maybe we should explain it. Those are things like, they're not like best show or however you would phrase it, but they are things like best lighting, best costuming, best direction, best, you know, there's the sort of the components of the show. And you're saying by judging those first, and evaluating those first, then the judges or the adjudicators get a chance to kind of think, okay, wait a minute, were the components exactly what they should have been? And they talk about this, obviously, between themselves, don't they?
Exactly right. Well, yeah. we've loosened the rules about whether or not they can talk to each other, too, because we found out that, well, this is over several years of sort of exploration and investigation and thinking about it. We found that the fact that they can't talk to each other doesn't make the adjudications better, and it doesn't make the decision-making process better. It just makes them isolated.
Yeah.
Okay. So that's loosened a little bit too, and that's all detailed in the handbook as well.
Right. Now, let me ask you another. Do you have a question, John?
I do. But if we're talking about adjudications, let's just continue to talk about adjudications.
Right.
So, and mine has nothing to do with adjudications. Well, so let's continue.
I want to ask something different. What is the maximum number of shows that you can accept for, say, a regional competition? And what's the minimum? I mean, if you have less than four entries, do you just say, well, forget it and come back next year after next or whenever the next is?
No. If there's more than one, you've got a potential festival because somebody still has to win to move on, right?
Right.
Now, and as far as maximum numbers, well, and as for regionals, Southeast Theater Conference has 10 states, and each could potentially send two shows. So you could have a 20-show festival potentially at DC.
Wow. Yeah.
So which means that they're well aware that that could happen. So when they schedule, they keep that in mind in advance of knowing what all the shows are. Now, most regions aren't that big. Most regions would have four, five, six states. So it's a little simpler where you have a maximum six to eight productions at the regional. That's pretty easy to schedule.
Yeah.
Do you have many that don't have, that would like to host a festival, but don't have the right kind of facilities?
Well, that don't have the right facilities in their town. Well,
yeah.
I have kind of mixed feelings about that. My opinion about festival is, part of the great thing about festival is you'd adapt. You must adapt to whatever space you're going to. So if you monitor your show in a proscenium situation, and then and you go to the state festival and it's in Thrust, well, you'll know that well enough in advance. You should probably adapt to Thrust, you know. And that's, to me, that's part of the exciting part of it.
Yeah.
So if it's a matter of stage configuration, usually that can be worked around. Now, if you've got like a black box with absolutely no wing space or no place to store anything, going to be difficult.
Yeah.
However, the Louisiana Festival this year is going to be in a black box.
Interesting.
Wow.
So we'll see. So we'll see. And wait a minute. Let me think about this. I guess I've been to one festival, and that was in Maine in a black box, but they set it up as if it was proscenium.
Okay.
They didn't have any wing space.
Yeah, really?
All right.
So they had to adapt to that, but.
So what, when you've watched other festivals, I guess, then what are some of the things that have made the best festivals you've gone to? What have some companies done to make these festivals really special and interesting weekends?
You're talking about the host now, correct?
Yeah, just about the host and the state, you know, you have to work in conjunction with the state to make these things happen too. So,
well, I'll tell you what I think really, really works well I'm going to talk mostly about hospitality now, because that, to me, it can make or break a festival. I like to see a state festival have designated volunteers that are sort of the shepherd for each group that's coming in. So, years ago, one of my early adjudication gigs, they assigned a host to shepherd me around. But then I took a show into festival, and that company had a host specifically for the company. Now, that was just great, because we got introduced to people, we got taken around and made sure we had all our questions answered. We got to meet a bunch of other people that way, because our host made sure we did, and made sure we mixed it up at the parties and functions and so on. So hospitality is the key to making a festival be successful and making people feel like they've been through a worthwhile event.
Yeah.
I would spend a lot of time putting together a hospitality committee, putting together people that make the companies coming in feel comfortable.
Yeah. I think we had pretty good hospitality people at the National at Carmel last year, especially. Yes. And it was very helpful because you had somebody you could call too, that, yes, that if you had a question, where was something, how do you know, et cetera, they could at least help you. They had someone designated to kind of help you with the town, you mm-hmm. know? And so that was a nice element to it. Plus, yeah, if you having good people on site that are, you know, essentially moving the different companies around to the right spots when they have to be at the right spots is very, very good.
Yeah, and I just think the more information you can impart to the companies, the better off you are and the better off they are. The whole secret is to not let any company feel isolated, to feel like they've come in for no reason.
Right, right.
It has to be a positive experience. And I mean, it has to be a celebration. I mean, let's face it. That's what these are really about. And I think that if a host focuses on the fact that they're producing a celebration, not a contest, and the contest becomes secondary to the celebration.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
It's a lot that's more fun, idea. A lot more interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I like that idea. Yeah. I'm not sure it'll ever totally take over, but I like it.
Yeah, I mean, because
everybody goes to win, so that's a contest.
They do, and it's you know, that's a mindset that's difficult to end. But I mean, unfortunately, the nature of the beast, when you have shows that advance through levels, the nature of the beast is competitive because somebody has to win in order to advance.
Right.
Right.
Now, well, I've always been an advocate once people got to National Festival to throw winning losing out the window, but that probably will always fall on deaf ears.
Well, I think we were at Nationals last time around and didn't place. We got some of the caption awards, but is you know I felt that you know you get at that level, you've got a lot of. Everybody's kind of at the same level for the most part in terms of absolutely. The shows that are there. And so it gets kind of subjective. It's got to be awfully hard for the adjudicators. So, you know, it was something we went away kind of disappointed, but not really that disappointed. I guess that's what I would say.
I know you came over with a few awards and that's good. And I don't think the cool thing is too, is that, adjudicators generally, I don't know if they're necessarily told to, but they generally don't feel like they have to spread the awards around. So the awards you got were honest, John. So that's a good thing.
They were not pity awards. That's nice to know.
No, oh, yeah. No,
I didn't have that impression.
If the caption awards were there, but the rankings of the show wasn't important and didn't happen, I think that would be ideal. Not everybody feels that way, obviously. You know, a lot of people do go on and go through the festival system because they want to win.
Right. Yeah. Right. Well, and it's a big expense. And even if you're taking almost no set, you've still got expenses for hotel rooms and entry fees and food. It's a big undertaking. And so a lot, you know, as a theater, you do want to walk away with an award, you know?
That's true.
You do. You do. Yeah. Yes, you do. Sure you do. And I get that too, having been on both sides of it.
Sure. Sure.
So I guess the big deal here is, of course, is that pre-planning, getting way out ahead of this, if you're actually putting on a festival or if you're an organization that's putting one on, getting way out ahead of it and you know, getting all the, is it really getting the people lined up, the people in a row to actually do the jobs? Is that mostly the first critical step, really?
Boy, I think it is, and the festivals where there's a chair that doesn't delegate are the tough ones.
Yeah, or someone tries to do it all themselves.
Something's going to fall through the cracks. Now, I should mention too that on the ACT website, act.org, there's a festivals home there, on one of the drop-down boxes. There's a festivals home, and on there there's a link. There's also a link to a manual for how to host a festival.
Cool.
That's got some pretty useful information in it, and it's got a calendar, a timeline as to how far out you should start and what things should happen when. It's a suggestion. It doesn't mean it has to be that way. And obviously, in some states where you cannot get a festival together until, you know, 5 months before the festival, it's not possible to start 2 years out. But that handbook is a good thing to look at, because even if the timeline isn't accurate for any given festival, there are still suggested activities, planning activities that lead to the festival that are good to look at.
Right. Yeah. And of course, there are festivals in the off years too. So a lot of states do that as well.
Yep.
So All right. Well, hey, thank you very much. We've been talking to Ron Ziegler, who is, say the title again, Field Services.
Field Services Director.
Field Services Director for the American Association of Community Theaters. Thanks a lot for being with us and for giving us this insight into how to plan and execute, and I say that in the very nicest of terms. A theater festival leading into the festival cycle that goes from state, regional, and national. So thanks for being with us.
Hey, my pleasure.
Thank you. Just want to wrap things up here. You can remember, if you are want to listen to us online, we are at theatergeeks.com. You can find us there. You can find us on iTunes. You can find us on TuneIn Radio, Stitcher, On Demand Radio. What else, Marcia?
Apple TV, and of course,
which is iTunes as well. Yep. And so anywhere where good podcasts are bought and sold, and we also encourage you to stop by our store, the Theater Geek Store, at theatergeeks.com/store. That's easy to remember, right? Where we have hats, cups, mugs, and John's favorite thing.
I just let's go into Thanksgiving without me saying that.
Oh, okay. All right. Well, they have a really great...
I love the coffee mugs.
They have coffee mugs and cups and all that kind of stuff. T-shirts and good stuff. And the coffee mugs, of course, are the number one seller. And that's all from us. I'm Dave DeFore.
I'm John Schaub.
And I'm Marcia Fulmer. And we are Theater Geeks.
Music for Theater Geeks was provided by MusicAlley.com. Theater Geeks is a production of the DuFour Creative Network.